Shalom. My name is Ryan White and of Rooted in Torah Ministries, and we are continuing on with righteousness and justice and looking at it from the ancient Near Eastern perspective. Now, if you remember when we left off, we had just talked about how important righteousness and justice was, how it was the landmark of a righteous king, and particularly what is important to understand is how righteousness and justice was established, how the signal of freedom was proclaimed throughout the land. Remember, there was three key things. There was the blowing of the shofar, there was the lifting up of a torch, or there was the raising up of a pole or a banner, that specifically at the gate to a city, which was a indication of the establishment of righteousness and justice. So what I want to do is I want to take you in, and we're going to look at a map of the ancient world, the ancient Near East, and near the time when Yeshua lived. And this is very important. Remember, over, I think it was about 700 years prior to the time of Yeshua, the northern kingdom was sent into exile, right? They were sent up, all the way up into the Assyrian kingdom, and eventually they dispersed throughout the entire world. And also Judah, right? Judah was sent into exile into Babylon. And from there, a lot of them actually dispersed. Not all of them. In fact, historians believe that only 5% of the people returned from the Babylonian exile to the land of Judea afterwards. So let's look at how they would return. Okay. Now remember, a lot of times that the whole concept of returning to Yahweh in Scripture is the wrapped up in the Hebrew word mikadem, which means from the east. And if you look at the map, right, you've got Jerusalem here, and then off to the directly to the east of it is where you have Babylon. Now, if you look on this map, you can see these little red lines that are running through the picture here, this map. And what those are, those were the well-known international trade routes of the day, right? In between Jerusalem and Babylon, what you have is a desert. People wouldn't just go across the desert because there's no source of water. Without water, you cannot travel. There's no life, right? They didn't have cars that could drive them across there in a speedy amount of time, so they'd have water. So they'd have to travel along one of these routes. And obviously this one that goes through the Arabian Desert, through Dumas, probably wouldn't have been a very good route. So it's very well known that when returning from Babylon back to Israel, they would come from Babylon, they would go up north, northwest along this Euphrates River, and then they would cut across, and they end up coming down alongside of Israel in this manner, and they come down along what's known as the King's Highway until they get right near Jerusalem. And then you can see what they do, and you see on this zoomed in map, is they come down and then they cross across this valley here, come through Jericho. They'll come a little bit south, and then once again they enter into Jerusalem. They come from the east and they're heading west. Okay, now this is very important, because what is the very first thing that you see when you come from the east towards Jerusalem? Well, on the east side of the city, that's where the temple was. And specifically, if you're coming from that direction, you have to come across the Mount of Olives. Okay, so you come over the Mount of Olives, and if you've ever been to the Mount of Olives, you'll know that from there you could see out across, you've got the Kidron Valley, and right across there you can see what's now is sadly the Dome of the Rock, but back then you would be able to see the temple. You'd actually be able to see right into where the giant curtain was that separated the courtyard from the holy place. We've got to remember, and you can verify this in the writings of Alfred Edersheim. He quotes the Mishnah on this. There was more than one curtain, right? The veil that was there on the temple, there was more than one of them. There was an outer veil that separated the courtyard from the holy place, and then there was the inner veil, which separates the holy place from the most holy place. Okay? So, with that in mind, we've got to ask ourselves, what's so significant about this? Well, let me tell you. We got to understand, where was Yeshua crucified? Traditionally, it said he was crucified on the north side of Jerusalem. And unfortunately, that is based on very poor evidence. In fact, from my studies, I've been able to discern basically the evidence for that is that around 500 years ago, they found a stone there that looked like a skull. And so they said, oh, this is the place of the skull, Golgotha, place of the skull. The problem is that it no longer looks like a skull, right? It only looked like a skull because of weather erosion, and now it doesn't 500 years later. So if we went back in time 500 years, you think it probably didn't look like a skull back then? Yeah. Go back 1,500 years, probably did not look like a skull then. So it's based on very weak evidence. However, we do have actual really good evidence of where Yeshua was crucified. First off, Golgotha, place of the skull. If you take that into the Hebrew, that would be place of the head. And if you understand, especially in the Mishnaic Hebrew, the place of the head is counting of the heads. That's where they did the census, okay? And if you look at the evidence, place where they did the census was on the Mount of Olives. Also, when we look at the Gospels, what does it say? It says that when Yeshua died, that the veil was rent. And particularly, who witnessed this? The centurion who was standing there at the cross bore witness that the veil rent. Well, let me ask you, if he was standing on the north side of Jerusalem, could he have seen the veil renting? No, he couldn't have. He couldn't see into the temple complex there. Only from the Mount of Olives on the east side could you actually see, and he would have seen the outer veil that is being rent. It was not the inner veil, it was the outer veil that was rent in two. And so, when we see this, if you look here, this is a picture of the Kidron Valley. And obviously, this is the current Kidron Valley. This isn't when Yeshua's day. But over here, you've got, this is the altar of the red heifer. This is where Yeshua would have been sacrificed. And from here, you can actually have a direct line of sight into the temple. He could have seen that. And this is literally, here. These are the gates to the city right here, right where the temple is, right? So, this place, the Mount of Olives, literally is right in front of the city. So when you're returning from the exile, right, you come from the east. The first thing you'd have to come across returning from the exile, and this is all just a picture of the greater work. Realize that. But when you're returning from the exile, you had to come from the east. And so you're crossing over the Mount of Olives. And let's say you happen to be crossing over on the day that Yeshua was crucified. What is it that you're going to see? You're going to literally see this. You're going to see this banner, literally, this pole, literally in front of the temple, standing right there. And just as Yeshua said, he says, now is the judgment of this world, and the ruler of this world will be driven out. Remember, judgment happens when justice and righteousness occurs. The ruler being driven out, he's driving him out to drive out the oppression. And when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people unto myself. Yeshua is referencing this concept of the raising up of the banner. When Isaiah 11, verse 10, when he writes that on that day the root of Yishai will stand as a signal to all the peoples and nations will inquire of him and his dwelling place will be glorious, he's referencing Yeshua literally standing as a banner. And of course, that is figuratively showing that righteousness and justice has been established, that the exiles can be regathered. And that's why the disciples went out to the entire four corners of the earth. They were charged with going out and regathering the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So, what also happened when Yeshua was crucified? Well, if you go to Matthew's gospel, he records that about the ninth hour, Yeshua cries out in a loud voice, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's, of course, referencing Psalms 22, which starts out the same way. Now, there's a couple little arguments about Hebrew versus Aramaic. This is kind of the Aramaic rendering of that, but that's okay. Right? That's okay. People spoke. The language had changed a little bit. And so terminology had changed a little bit. But Yeshua is referencing Psalms 22. Psalms 22 is the cry of the suffering servant, right? The cry out from oppression. And it says that Yeshua cried out again in a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. So all this time, he's been silent, completely silent when he's being tortured and suffering. And yet suddenly, he cries out. Does that seem like that might seem significant? Yeah, absolutely. But how are we going to know how significant this is? We've got to look at the culture and the context. What does it mean when someone cries out? We see that the crying out happens throughout scriptures. We see that Abel, right? Abel's blood cried out from the ground, from the oppression of Cain murdering him. Israel cried out from their slavery. In fact, God did not come down to rescue them until they cried out. Isn't that interesting? It wasn't until Israel cries out from their slavery that Yahweh rescues them. Israel at the Red Sea, what happens again? Pharaoh's army is there, they're in danger. It says that they cried out, and Yahweh responds by parting the Red Sea. Moshe, he cries out when there's no water, and Yahweh responds by giving them water. And then what's really interesting, to completely wrap this up, to show you the importance of crying out in Scripture, go read the book of Judges again. What happens every single time? Bad stuff happens. The Philistines invade the land. The people get oppressed. And every single time it says, the people cried out and God raises up a judge. That's always the precursor to this, is that the people cry out from their oppression and God responds to that. So very, very important. And Yeshua cried out right before he was about to die. So why would he have cried out? Well, it's because of a very important institution that is actually, they found it in all legal cultures, the Code of Hammurabi, Eshnunna, even up through recent history, even in Germany, up before the Holocaust and stuff happened, Germany had this institution. And basically what it was is that whenever a person is crying out, in which a wrong needs to be righted, if a person found themselves in a situation where they were in acute need, they would cry out, and anybody who was within hearing was legally obliged to come to the aid of that person crying out for assistance. Otherwise, they would be just as guilty as the person oppressing them. Now think about that in today's culture. What has happened to our culture in America today? When someone's crying out, do people always respond? It's been so sad. I've seen this multiple times on the news recently. Some little old lady or someone is in a parking lot and they're being mugged, or someone's jumped them and started beating them. And what is the American response to that? Oh, quickly, I've got to get out my cell phone and record this. They're not worried about jumping in and actually stopping what's going on. They're more worried, can I get this recorded so I can get it up on YouTube and get a million hits? In Yahweh's culture, they would be legally required to answer to the same crimes as the person who's physically beating up on that person. They're legally culpable. You can see this in the Mari text, for example. It says, whenever an oppressed man or woman cries out to you, you will rise up and do him justice. Right? They understood that as being legally required. Now, we got to ask ourselves, does the Torah say anything about this? Because we have to have evidence in the Torah. So where's the evidence? Let's look at Exodus 22, verse 22 through 24. Yahweh says, you shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he cries out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the swords, and your wives will become widows, and your children will become fatherless. Does that sound pretty serious? That scares me. If I am doing something that causes someone to cry out, especially if it's a widow or an orphan, God's going to do to them, to me, what I intended to do to them, or worse. That Yahweh takes this very, very seriously. When you make someone cry out, remember, what's the word for crying out? It's that word tsa'aka, right? Very similar to tzedaka, but it's tsa'aka. Is it possible that sometimes when we think we're being righteous, that we are actually out causing someone to tsa'aka, to cry out? If we do that, Yahweh here is saying, I will come to their rescue, and it's not going to be pretty for you. He said, I will kill you with the sword, and your wives will become widows, and your children fatherless. That's pretty much the harshest words you can think of especially in the context of the Torah. Did Yeshua ever teach anything about this? Absolutely. Let's go to Luke chapter 18, verse 1. Now he was telling them a parable to show that all the times they ought to pray and not lose heart, saying, "In a certain city there was a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. There was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, 'Give me legal protection from my opponent.' For a while he was unwilling, but afterwards he said to himself, 'Even though I am not a God-fearer nor a respectful man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection. Otherwise, by continually coming, she will wear me out.' And the master, Yeshua, said, 'Hear that what this unrighteous judge said. Now, will not God bring justice for his elect who cry out to him night and day? Will he not delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?'" So right there, Yeshua is referencing this concept of crying out, and yet this unrighteous king, this unrighteous judge, he decides he's not going to do anything, but because this woman keeps nagging at him, he's going to eventually respond to this crying out. Now, do we serve a righteous king or an unrighteous king? We serve a righteous judge, right? We serve a righteous king. And Yeshua is saying, for surely, he will respond. When we cry out, he will respond. And now, he may not respond right away, but we must know that he will respond. And so when Yeshua cried out, God is legally required to respond. And how does God respond? Remember, what's the term for Elohim, or for God in Hebrew? I just gave it away there. It's Elohim. Elohim is sometimes actually used of men because it's a term associated with judge. It literally could be rendered as the mighty judge. Okay? And if Yahweh is Elohim, which he is, he must be the mighty judge. And what is the duty of a judge? Let's go to Deuteronomy 25, verse 1. It says, "If there is a dispute between men, and they shall go to court, the judge shall decide their case, and they will justify the righteous," that word righteous there is tzaddik, "and will condemn the wicked," the rasha, wicked. Right? So the legal duty of a judge is when there's a dispute, when someone cries out, he enters into judgment. The person who cried out and the person who is causing the oppression. And he must judge between the cases. He has to look at it. Is Yeshua tzaddik? Is he righteous? Or is the one who caused him to cry out in oppression righteous? Now, who caused him to cry out in oppression? Well, we saw the causative agent is mankind, right? But remember what we read earlier in John, where it said that now is the judgment of this world when the ruler of this earth, it says, let me read this verbatim, "Now is the judgment of this world, and now the ruler of this world will be driven out." So ultimately, what do we know? We know that ultimately it's Satan who's behind mankind's rebellion. And so when God is entering into judgment, he's judging between what two parties? Between Yeshua and between Satan. And according to the Torah, what do? You determine which party is righteous and which party is wicked. And they shall justify the righteous. Okay? With that in mind now, and remember we talked about this in the honor and shame part, so keep in mind the honor and shame aspect of it. Let's read Romans 3, verse 21 through 26, and take careful note of what it specifically says here. It says, "But now, independent of the law," aside from the Torah, outside of that legal context of the Torah, "the justice of God has been disclosed." Okay, so what happened with Yeshua? It was the revealing of God's justice. And it is attested by the law and the prophets. So the Torah and the Nevi'im, the prophets, they have to attest of what was going on. "The justice of God through the faithfulness of Yeshua Messiah for all who believe." So Yeshua was faithful. He stood for what was righteous and true, even up to the face of death. He suffered through those things for righteousness' sake. He died the most shameful death for the sake of righteousness. For now there is no distinction, since all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Remember, that's the problem with sin, is that sin causes us to fall short of God's glory. We are shamed through our sin. Okay? They are now justified. Remember, justified, that term means declared right, declared righteous, which links right back to what? To Deuteronomy 25. The judge determines one party to be in the right, righteous, just. He justifies one party, and he declares the other party to be wicked. So they are now justified by his grace as a gift. And we're going to learn about that in the next part of this series. Through the redemption, remember, redemption means to restore honor that is in Messiah Yeshua. Now, this next part, this next line, none of your Bibles are going to say this, and the problem is that they're trying to theologically translate the Greek into something it's not meant to be, right? Paul was writing to the Romans. The Romans spoke Greek. Paul was writing in Greek. If you look at this, it will say, whom God presented as propitiation or as a sin sacrifice, sometimes it's rendered, through faithfulness in his blood. The problem is that's not what the Greek text says. You have to stick to what the text says. You can't go out and theologically change it just because it fits your own theology, your own agenda, right? The word there is hilasteron. Or hilasterion. I'm not that great with Greek pronunciation yet. I'm working on that. Hilasterion. That word is only found one other time in the New Testament, and that's in the book of Hebrews. Guess what it's referring to? It's referring to the covering of the Ark of the Covenant, what's oftentimes called the mercy seat. And so that's where a lot of times, you know, that's where they get this idea of propitiation, because that's what they focus on. That's what the theological world, who translated our English, our Bibles into English, that's what they focus on, is a propitiation, is assuaging God's wrath. It's the removal of wrath. But is that what the mercy seat is about? Okay. In fact, when you go and you go look at the Septuagint, every single time, this word is never used to translate as atonement or as forgiveness of sins or anything. It is exclusively used in reference to the mercy seat. Paul could have, if Paul wanted to talk about atonement or a sin sacrifice or anything like that, he could have used those words, but he didn't. He used the word hilasteron, which is the mercy seat. So, what was the function of the mercy seat? Well, of course, on the day of Yom Kippur, the priest would bring in the blood of one of the goats, and he would sprinkle it on the mercy seat. And that was done, you've got to read the text carefully, and we're going to talk about this later on in the series when we get into the leper Messiah, about the function of the sacrifices, because I'll propose to you that, unfortunately, scholarship the system of Christianity, I'm not putting blame on people, I'm just saying that people have been so focused on studying sacrifices from the perspective of the book of Hebrews. But remember, the book of Hebrews was written hundreds of years after the book of Leviticus. It was written, probably about 1,000 years afterwards, right? It was assuming that the people reading the book to the Hebrews already knew Leviticus. They'd already read Leviticus. They understood those things. So we shouldn't be trying to read Hebrews and saying, see, that's what Leviticus means. We should be studying Leviticus and going, okay, now I understand that. Now let me go and read Hebrews so I can figure out what Hebrews is really trying to say. Okay? So, anyways, back to the point here. If you study out specifically the day of Yom Kippur, the blood of that sacrifice that was brought to the Holy of Holies is not for willful rebellious sin. The willful rebellious sins were confessed and put on the goat that is sent away, that is not sacrificed. There was no sacrifice for willful rebellious sin. The reason why the blood of that other goat was brought into the sanctuary was to cleanse the sanctuary from the uncleanliness of the children of Israel. Because of their sin and because of their impurity, the sanctuary becomes defiled and has to be ritually cleansed. Okay, we'll get into that later on. But So that was one function of that seed, but it sat there 364 days of the year outside of that, right? So what was it normally used for? Well, when you read about it, and actually it even talks about it in Leviticus 16, Yahweh talks about this is where I appear above the mercy seat. The mercy seat was where that was God's throne, right? That when they went out into battle and they carried it on their shoulders, other kingdoms did the same thing, except for they were carrying the throne of their king who was sitting up there. That's the Ark of the Covenant literally was God's throne on earth. And so when we take that concept of it being the throne room, it being the place where mankind met with God, where there was communication between the two of them, where there was communion between man and God, that was the mercy seat. And so it says, redemption in Messiah Yeshua, whom God presented the mercy seat, or as a mercy seat, right? Yeshua is that connection between God and man, between man and God, back and forth. That is Yeshua. He is the door. He's the one who, just like the high priest of old, he's the one who provides that communication. So better rendered, Yeshua was presented as a mercy seat through faithfulness in his blood. Now the term blood could be blood or could be bloods, pluraled. And if you look at in the Hebrew, whenever blood is pluraled, it doesn't necessarily talking about an atonement. It can be talking about murder. When Abel's blood cried out, it uses damim, which is plural, bloods, which is blood that is shed out unjustly. Okay, which is the whole context of Yeshua. He did show his justice, Yahweh's justice, because in his divine forbearance, he passed over sins previously committed. And it was to prove at the present time that he himself is just and that he justifies the one who has faith in Yeshua. So it was to prove that Yahweh was just, that he himself justifies, he declares right. He takes that person, the accuser of the brethren, Satan is accusing us. And through Yeshua, God says, no, this man, this human being is just, and you, Satan, you are wicked. That is the context of Romans 3, verse 21 through 26 here, is the concept of Yahweh showing himself just through the resurrection of Yeshua, our Messiah. I hope that makes sense. We're going to go ahead and we're going to take a quick break here and we'll be right back. Shalom, welcome back. The next part, now that we've established that Yeshua has established justice and righteousness through his death, the next part with establishing justice and righteousness was that they had to grant freedom and restore the individual rights. What the biggest thing with this entailed was understanding, especially because a lot of times the people were considered to be slaves of someone, and that was probably the biggest part of establishing justice and righteousness was the release of the people, is that it was understood that the people weren't freed from slavery to just be free to do whatever they wanted. They were actually being transferred from slavery to a person or the government to the service, to the slavery to one's own God. We could see this principle, for example, in the Torah. You could go to Leviticus 25, verse 42. It says, for they are my servants or my slaves, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, they are not to be sold as slaves. Right? It was understood that Israel, because they were freed from Egypt, they became not free, but they became slaves of God. We can see here in Romans 6, verse 16 through 18, it says, do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as a slave for obedience, that you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either to sin resulting in death, or of obedience resulting in righteousness? But thanks be to God that though you were slaves to sin, you became obedient from the heart to that form of teaching which you have been committed. And having been freed from sin, you become slaves of righteousness. So no longer slaves to sin, but slaves to righteousness. Now this is a very important chapter to analyze in the book of Romans. Why? Because there's a particular verse, Romans 6, verse 23, that is blown completely out of context. Okay? What is Paul talking about here? What is the theme? The theme here is slavery to sin or slavery to righteousness, right? And he says, I'm speaking in human terms because of the weakness of the flesh. For you presented yourselves as members to impurity and to lawlessness, resulting in further lawlessness. Now present your members as slaves to righteousness, resulting in sanctification. For when you were slaves to sin, you were regarded as free to righteousness. So what he's doing is he's talking about being a slave to sin, personifying sin as a master, or personifying righteousness as a master. And who is ultimately, who's the king of sin? That's Satan, right? So we could say you are slaves to Satan, and who is the king of righteousness? Yahweh, and he gives Yeshua the kingship, right? So Yeshua is the king of righteousness. So either you're a slave to Yeshua or a slave to Satan. Now look at verse 23, and now that we understand the context going on here, it says, for the wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Messiah Yeshua, our master. So with that in mind, is Paul saying that if you sin, that you deserve to die? No, that is not what Paul is saying. And unfortunately, that has been the misunderstanding of that verse. He's saying the wages of sin. Sin here in context is the master that you are a slave to. That doesn't mean that every time you commit a sin that you deserve death. In fact, if you read the Torah, it's very clear. If you commit a crime of stealing, you do not deserve death. There's a punishment for it, but it's not deserving of death. If you know, there's only certain sins, i.e. willful rebellious sins, that are deserving of death. Not every sin results in death, or that leads to death. It's saying here that this wages of sin, remember, sin is a personification of, ultimately, of Satan. So it's basically saying here that if you are a slave to Satan, all that he does is he pays you out in death, right? Whereas if you're a slave to Yeshua, to righteousness, you get the free gift of eternal life. Even if you mess up, even if you sin, there's forgiveness. Because why? You're a slave to righteousness. You're a slave to the Master Yeshua. So what's going on here? When Yeshua established justice and righteousness, we are transferred from being slaves to Satan, who pays out in death, to being slaves to Yeshua, who pays out in eternal life. And just to back up what I just said, if you want a scriptural reference for that, 1 John 5:18. Okay, let's go there really quickly. 1 John 5:18. It says, we know that no one who is born of God sins, but he who was born of God keeps him, and evil does not touch him. Verse 17. Okay. all unrighteousness is sin, and there is sin not leading to death. So John, who, by the way, John was a priest. If you read the Quarta Decimen controversy, you'll see that there's evidence that John was a priest. He understood these things. The duty of a priest is to teach the Torah. And so John, a priest, says, all unrighteousness is sin, and there is sin that is not leading to death. Now, where would he get that from? The Torah, because the Torah shows that there is sins that are not leading to death, okay? So, with that in mind, where do we see justice and righteousness in the Torah? Absolutely, we see it. If you look at the Ten Commandments are based around justice and righteousness. And remember, our two symbols. If we go to Exodus 20, verse 18, we can actually see two of these signals being shown here. Okay? Right after the giving of the Ten Commandments, it says, all the people saw, and in the English it will say, thunders and lightning flashes and the sound of a shofar and the mountain smoking. And the people saw it and they trembled and stood at a distance. Now, if you go into the rabbinical writings, they say that tongues of fire came down. Where are they getting that from? Well, maybe they read the Hebrew. Because in the Hebrew, the word there translated as thunder is kolot, which is from the root word there is kol, which is voice. Whenever someone's calling out, that's why it's translated as thunders, is because it's a loud voice, basically. So you have a voice. Then it says lightning flashes. The word there for lightning is the Hebrew word lapidim, which is plural of lapid. right? Well, guess what Lapid means? If you go in and you do a word study on this and you look at all the times this is translated, it is almost about 80% of the time translated as torch or torches. So that's where they get the tongues of fire from. But isn't that interesting? What was the signal of freedom? It was a torch and the voice of the shofar, the sound of a shofar. So right there at Mount Sinai, we had a shofar blast and we had a torch. Or what, you know, and maybe it was lightning, I don't know. I wasn't there. But if you look in the Hebrew, that word that they use there is the word for torch. Now what's really interesting is that we find another place, and also says the mountain was smoking. If you go to, which is the Hebrew word there is Ashen, if you go to Genesis 15, verse 17, this is the covenant of the pieces. This is where Abraham falls asleep, and he dreams a dream, and Yahweh basically shows him that he's going to be, his descendants will be slaves for 400 years, and he makes a covenant with them, which is the basis for our faith, is the covenant made with Abraham, the covenant of the pieces. And the thing is that what passed between the pieces? You see, in an ancient Near Eastern covenant-making ceremony, the two parties, they would walk through the covenant of the pieces, and basically they would say, you know, whatever happens to has happened to these animals, may it happen to us, right? If I break the covenant but with you and I should be cut in half and be dead like this. That's how humanity does covenants. But our God is greater than humans, right? We saw at the cross at humanity's injustice was shown, the perversion of our ways, the injustice of our ways. And so Yahweh uses this and he shows not two people walking through there, but he specifically shows, it says, a smoking oven and a flaming torch. Well, where do you find these same words at? That torch is, once again, our word lapid. It's a lapid esh, a torch of fire, if you will. And the smoking oven is tanur ashan, which is, ashan is that same thing. When the mountain was smoking, that was what was there at Mount Sinai. We see that here. So right here, the things that passed between the pieces were there at Mount Sinai when justice and righteousness was established. So is it possible that Yahweh is trying to show Abraham? Not that if he messes up that God's going to kill Abraham, but that God is going to act in justice and righteousness. Let me ask you a question. Now that we've understood honor and shame, why is it that if two people were in covenant, if someone broke the covenant, that they would have to die? It's because if you and I are in covenant, just like with a husband and wife, if the wife commits adultery, or the husband, we could say that too, according to the Torah, what happens? They're supposed to be put to death. Why? Because, remember, they're not a guilt-based society. The problem is that they've brought intense shame upon their covenant partner or their marriage partner. And so in order to restore the honor of their partner, that person has to be put to death. And yet Yahweh is going to show that it is not about the death. It's about the establishment of justice and righteousness. It's by them walking through the pieces that Yahweh took it upon himself through Yeshua to be say that he was going to be the one who restored honor to the covenant partner who has been shamed because of Israel's actions. Does that make sense to you? I really hope that makes sense to you. This is just such an important topic for us to understand, not just to understand the scriptures and the work of Yeshua, but as we're going to see, it's going to play out into how do we live out our lives according to the works of the Messiah, according to justice and righteousness, which is the foundation of the throne of Yahweh and is the foundation for Yeshua's ministry. So with that in mind, let's look and let's be sure, because we only quoted one verse. We only quoted Jeremiah 23, verse 5. Are there other verses that show us that Yeshua's ministry should have been focused on justice and righteousness? Absolutely. Let's go to Isaiah 9, verse 6 through 7. I know this is a favorite one to quote. For a child will be born to us, and a son will be given to us. The government will rest upon his shoulders, and his name, his authority, his honor, will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government, or of Shalom, peace. on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. So very clearly, this child that is born, who's going to have the government on his shoulders and be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, he will uphold it with justice and righteousness. We can go to Isaiah 11, verse 10 through 12, and we already read that. Remember, the returning of the exiles, that was the duty of Messiah, to restore the exiles, which is justice and righteousness. Jeremiah 23, verse 5, we already read that earlier, but that one is talking about David, the righteous branch who will bring forth righteousness and justice. Jeremiah 33, verse 15, in those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he will execute justice and righteousness on the earth. Now, let's go to James 1, verse 25 through 27 and see what was the focus of Yeshua's ministry. Did he establish justice and righteousness? James writes, "But one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, the Torah of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer of the law, this man will be blessed by what he does. And if anyone thinks himself religious, but yet does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit the widows and the orphans in their distress and to keep oneself unstained from the world." So religion's not about how you dress. It's not about how long your tzitzit are. It's not all about how long you pray. It's not about how well you keep Shabbat. Religion, pure and undefiled, is taking care of your brother, is being your brother's keeper. How important is this? Let's look at Acts chapter 10, verse 1 through 4. It reads, "In Caesarea there was a man by the name of Cornelius. He was a centurion of the Italian cohort, as it was called. He was a devout man who feared God with all his household. He gave alms generously to the people and prayed constantly to God." So he gave alms and he prayed. By the way, if you go into the Greek, I don't remember the exact word, but if you take that word back into the Hebrew, it's either translated from tzedakah or chesed. Chesed is covenant loyalty, or tzedakah is acts of righteousness. One afternoon at about 3 o'clock, he had a vision in which he clearly saw an angel of God coming to him and saying, "Cornelius." And he stared in terror and said, "What is it, sir?" And he answered him, "Your prayers and your alms and your righteous acts have ascended as a memorial before God." So this person who feared God, but he was not part of God's people because God's people wouldn't allow him into the kingdom. But that's a whole other story. Because of his prayers and his giving of alms, it ascended as a memorial. That wording there, ascended as a memorial, it's the same words that are used in the book of Leviticus with the sacrifices. And because of that, an angel appeared to him. How many of you have had an angel appear to you and do this with you, right? We can see how important it was for this guy who wasn't even king. He couldn't establish justice and righteousness in the fullest sense, but because he was doing these acts of justice and righteousness, an angel of God appears before him. So how can we, as individuals, establish justice and righteousness? I'm glad you asked. There's a great list that I've made up for you just for this special occasion, and these all come out of Scripture. In fact, a lot of them come out of Ezekiel 18, where it talks about how do you establish justice and righteousness. So, no idolatry, no defiling of your neighbor's wives. Do not oppress the alien, the orphan, the widow, the poor, or the Levite. Do not commit robbery. Restore a pledge to the debtor. Give bread to the hungry. Clothe the naked. Do not charge interest on your loans. Bring the homeless into your house. Do not shed innocent blood. Deliver those who have been robbed from the hand of the oppressor. Show kindness and mercy. Do not plot evil against your brother. Do not oppress your workers. Loose the bonds of injustice and the thongs of the yoke. Bring the homeless into your house. Clothe the naked. Do not hide yourself from your own kin. Stop pointing the fingers and speaking evilly. Keep the Shabbat for your household. Be eyes to the blind. Be feet to the lame. Be a champion to the cause of the stranger. Do you see a common thread that are running through all of these verses? And these are just cherry-picked out of verses. It's just for you. What's the common thread? The common thread is you are your brother's keeper. If you want to do justice and righteousness, which is the work of the kingdom, it's the weightier matter of the Torah, it is taking care of your brother, especially when he's in need. It's about not fighting with him, about clothing him, about feeding him, about rescuing him or her from the oppressed. That's our biblical mandate. That is what God, and if you look at it, just go reread all the scripture, right? If you go and you look overall throughout scripture, this is the major focus. Do a word search on justice and righteousness, and you'll see throughout the Torah. This is why the northern kingdom was sent into the Babylonian or into the Assyrian exile. This is why the kingdom of Judah was sent into the Babylonian exile. All of these things, they're all because of injustice, because of human beings acting of oppressing people instead of taking care of them. That is God's major concern with us. Now, does he want us to keep the Sabbath? Absolutely, but not if we're going to be violating our brother or fighting with him. The Shabbat is not a day that we should be fighting with people. We shouldn't be arguing. Now, we can have a great discussion on the Shabbat, no doubt, but we should not be arguing and getting angry with our brother, especially on the Shabbat, especially on that day. So, let's see what Paul says about this. This is really interesting. Romans 2, verse 13 through 15. Paul writes, "For it is not the hearers of the Torah that are righteous in the sight of Elohim, but the doers of the Torah that shall be justified." Wait a minute. Didn't Paul say the law was done away with? Oh, maybe we're misunderstanding him. Because Paul very clearly here says, it's not the hearers, but the doers, the ones who are doing Torah. So is it possible that when Paul is talking about the works of the law versus grace and faith, that maybe we're misunderstanding him? Because very clearly Paul says here, the doers of the Torah shall be justified. Maybe it has to do with our intent. "For the Gentiles who do not have the Torah, by nature do what is in the Torah, though not having Torah, they are a Torah to themselves. For they show the works of the Torah written on their hearts, and their conscience bears witness between themselves and their thoughts, accusing or perhaps even excusing in the day when Elohim shall judge the secrets of men through Yeshua Messiah according to my gospel." What's Paul saying here? The Gentiles who don't have Torah, they do the Torah having shown the Torah written on their hearts. How many Gentiles who have never read the Torah do you know keep the Sabbath? How many of them do you know keep the feasts? How many of them do you know that pronounce the name correctly? How many of them do you know that have the calendar figured out? None of them. They don't keep the Sabbath. They don't keep these things. And yet Paul is saying here that they, when they do the Torah, do by nature the Torah, they show the work of the Torah written on their hearts. So what's he talking about? He's talking about the weightier matters of the Torah, about taking care of your brother, about living a righteous lifestyle. And by righteous, I mean a lifestyle that is in accordance with justice and righteousness. Okay? Written on their hearts. By nature. Let me propose something to you. I cannot prove this, but I would propose to you, based on evidence, that everyone deep down inside knows what's good and right. I believe that Yahweh wrote the Torah in our DNA. That deep down inside, we all know, even if we've never read the Bible, we know when we're doing something wrong. And when we do something wrong, and we do continue to do it, we show the works of the Torah not written on our heart, even if we've never heard the Torah. But if people who've never had the Torah do them, they're showing the Torah written on their hearts. Now, does that mean that everyone's saved, or that, you know, we all get a free pass if we just do good? No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm just trying to show here is that the works of the Torah is more than just the Shabbat, the feast, these are very important. Don't get me wrong. These are vitally important. These are shadows of the Messiah. These prepare us. These give us blessings. But without the justice and righteousness in them, they're just vain religious observances. We must do justice and righteousness. We must keep the Shabbat. We must keep the feast with justice and righteousness. Instead of making the feasts about a time period where we're going to argue about the calendars or argue about how we're going to do things, why don't we focus on taking care of our brothers? Is not that the work that Messiah has set before us? Let's see what Yeshua says about this and about ultimately or our ultimate goal, right? Our ultimate goal is to be resurrected and be in the kingdom. And so in Matthew 25, verse 31 through 36, it reads, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory, his honor, and all nations will be gathered together before him, and he will separate the peoples one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from his goats. He'll put the sheep on his right, and he'll put the goats on his left. And he'll say to those on his right hand, he'll say, 'Come, you that are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world. For you have figured out the Shabbat and rebuked your family members. You calculated out the right calendar. You pronounced the name correctly. And you even figured out every single unkosher food additive. And you booted out all the members of your congregation who disagreed with you.'" That's the wrong version there. I'm sorry. I must have got the wrong version. Let's see what Yeshua actually said. He said, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared before you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." And the people are going to scratch their heads. They're going to look around, and they're going to go, but Master, Yeshua, I never even met you. I lived 2,000 years after you. When did I ever do this to you?" And Yeshua's going to look at them, and he's going to say, "If you've done it to the least of my brothers, it's the same thing as if you did it to me." By taking care of our brothers, by visiting them in prison, by clothing them, doing righteousness and justice, these are the things that put us on the right hand. These are what make us the sheep instead of the goats. These are the things that bring us into the kingdom. These are what Yeshua is asking us to do. Is it important to figure out the feast days? Is it important to figure out the Shabbat? Absolutely. And if you take anything away from this, please don't take away that I'm in any way minimizing the importance of those things. It's important that we learn the rules of kosher. We need to be a bride prepared for our kingdom. But along the way, we cannot forget that our biblical mandate is justice and righteousness, is taking care of people. And so sometimes, and I am just as guilty of this as anybody else who's feeling guilty of this, when I learned all these things, I went out and I started abusing my family members over it. I went out and, did you know, well, I was raised Seventh-day Adventist, so we already kept the Sabbath, but I went out and hammered them with the feast. Did you know you're a pagan for keeping Christmas? You know, and just hammering them. Is that what we've been called to do? To beat our people down over these things? Or is it to take care of people, and then when our family members go, "Wow, you know, Ryan has really changed," and I can attest to this and in my own personal life, they go, "Wow, Ryan has really changed. What is it that, why is it that you used to be like this, and now you're like this? What is the spirit that's driving you?" And I go, well, let me tell you. Let me tell you about the justice and righteousness of my King. Let me tell you about the Shabbat. Let me tell you about the feast days, about the importance of the calendar, about the importance of actually saying his name instead of calling him by a title of Lord. Let me tell you about the joys of the Torah. And the doors open a lot faster that way. When we keep in mind that it's about doing justice and righteousness, about the works of the king, the things that put us on the right hand and make us the sheep and not the goats. We're going to go ahead and end here, and we'll be back in the next part. I pray that you're enjoying this. Each and every day.